more.
Imagine being responsible for the Beatles. Now imagine them taking care of you. In this episode, you'll hear how God used George and his guru.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Hello and welcome to The Beatles, The Bible, and Beyond. I'm Brian Mason.
Hi, I'm Ken Mansfield, and I was lucky enough to be handpicked by the Beatles to be their first U.S. manager of their new record company, Apple Records.
Join us as we talk about the intersection of Jesus and music while sharing incredible stories from Ken's days in the music industry.
This is The Beatles, The Bible, and Beyond.
Ken, you made a few trips to London, and they weren't necessarily all pleasant, at least the trips themselves. And maybe, you know, once you got there, maybe everything was okay. But traveling from the United States to London, you've told me, was not always the most pleasant.
Well, you know, this was the 60s. I mean, it wasn't quite as convenient as it is now. And it's a long, long trip. I mean, if you just break it down, what, LA to New York is like 5 hours, and then New York to London is like another 5 hours, and you got to connect and lay over in New York. So it's pretty tiring. And flying east, and I talked to a lot of people, have the same thing about flying long distances east and long distances west. Something about flying east, when I land in Europe, I'm just wiped out. And usually the first day I just try to do nothing. And I can come back and get on the plane in London, and because of the time change, actually leave in the morning from London and walk in my office in the afternoon in L.A., and I'm ready to go. But for whatever reason, I was really, really busy with so many things at Capital that when it became necessary for me to come to London for meetings there, I didn't have the choice of having like really a lot of flights. I had to be at a certain time. So I land in London kind of late only meaning like 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night. And I am so tired, I can hardly stand up because of just my pressures from back at the Capitol Tower and stuff. And so I get there and I'm picked up by Apple and just dropped by the hotel just to check in and let them take up my luggage because whoever picked me up that time, I don't think it was Peter Asher, but said, come on by the building. We're kind of a neat thing here tonight, you know. And I get to the building and I am really, really not on my game, let's say. And the reason for it was, is they were showing Magical Mystery Tour up in one of the big rooms. And Magical Mystery Tour was not new at that particular time. It had been out for a while, but it had a very short run in the theaters. And most people never really got to see the film. So they were showing the film for all the Apple people and some friends that hadn't seen it and things like that. And so because I was coming in, they wanted to make sure I got to see the film too. So straight to the hotel, drop off the clothes, straight to the building. And I go upstairs and there was a certain aroma around that made me even more tired. And I'm standing there leaning against the desk because I'm starting to feel really weak and kind of faint. And people would come by and say, hey, Ken, how you doing, man? You know, da-da-da. And I just mumbled something, and all of a sudden I thought I was going to throw up or something. I mean, I was really in trouble, and we've talked at other times about keep it together and all this kind of stuff, and I thought, I am really not together right now, and I'm really scared, and I feel like I'm going to throw up standing right here in this room.
You cannot lose it now.
No. Talk about losing it. Yeah. On different levels, I couldn't lose it. And George comes over.
George Harrison.
George Harrison. He said, hey, Ken, when'd you get in? And I go. He said, well, the hotel okay? And I was afraid if I opened up my mouth and had a sentence that I was going to get sick. And he asked me another question, whatever it was, about just getting there or something about the film or something. And by my third or fourth answer, he just looked at me and he said, come on, man, you're out of here. And he took me to the hotel.
He himself. He didn't get Mal or a secretary or, hey, say, somebody call a cab for Ken.
No, I've never thought about those details on that, but no, he didn't. And what he did at that moment is he knew, because there had been other times when I could tell he understood the pressure I was in.
Right.
And he knew, because he traveled a lot too,
yeah,
and he knew I was in trouble physically. And so he just said, hey, man, you're out of here. And he took me and he drove me over to my hotel. And he took me up to my room and got me in and got my shoes off for me. I sat down on the bed, took my shoes off. And
wow,
he didn't undress me then,
right,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what he did is he just like spun my legs around and he said, man, you get some rest and don't worry. And I said, but I got meetings tomorrow. And he said, I'll cover for you. Don't worry, man. You get there when you feel okay. Now, this was a part of them that was so amazing, because I keep referring to how courteous they were and that I felt at times they were as concerned about me as I was about them. And this was just showing how they were so normal. It was just like a buddy taking care of a buddy, you know. And also making sure that I didn't get in trouble. You know, there was an awareness that, and I never said hey to the guys, you know, if I screw up, I'm in trouble. You know, I never said anything like that to them. But it's just that there was awareness. They knew the pressure.
Well, the moment you told me that story, George Harrison became my favorite Beatle.
Yeah.
Well, just the compassion of the man. But again, he could have just as easily, and it still would have been a great story, if he would have assigned that task to somebody else, saying, hey, take care of Ken.
Yeah.
Take him to his hotel. Yeah. Make sure he gets taken care of.
He probably just looked around and Mal wasn't there, and nobody said he wasn't just going to slough me off to somebody.
But he himself had a compassionate heart and said, I'm going to take care of my friend. That's great.
He and I spent the most time together after Apple, outside of Ringo, which we spent a lot of time, but our lives were intertwined for a while after that, and it was the kind of thing to where there could be just a quietness between us and just a warm friendship, that's all. It wasn't complicated at all, you know, and so.
This may be a good time to mention this. Because of that gentle relationship that you had, he was one that encouraged you, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but into the New Age life.
Eastern mysticism.
All that kind of stuff, wasn't he?
He was, but he never said, you know, Ken, here's what I believe and here's what I think you should, and you should start coming to our meetings or anything like that.
Right.
An interesting thing about George, very few people I've known in my life was really seeking God's heart. I mean, he really was a seeker, and he really was dedicated in his personal life, was being right with God and seeking God. As a Christian, you know, we'll have a conversation, well, he was deceived and all that, and in our belief, yes, he was, but he had this beautiful thing about him that was very, I'd have to say it, very godlike in his gentleness and his kindness and all this kind of stuff. When we were working on the Jackie Lomax thing, I'd gotten him a house up in Beverly Hills, and Patty was with him. So my wife at the time and Patty were friends and George, so it was just a natural, easy friendship. And in the early days, they didn't know a lot of people anyway yet in LA. That was a thing that was just forming. And so we were supposed to do something the next day after we did something else. And I called him on the phone. He didn't answer. And I called again. He didn't answer. And it was getting around the time we were supposed to get together. And I had something wanted to ask him or something. But anyway, just kept not answering the phone. So I said to my wife, I said, well, let's just go on over. We plan on getting together anyway. So we drive over and there's no answer to the door. So I walk around to the back of the house and down there to the pool. There's he and Patty sitting by the pool. So we saunter on down there, and Gentle George didn't seem so gentle right then because he got up and excused himself and went up to the house. And
Immediately,
yeah. So I turned to Patty and I said, what happened? He said, well, George is embarrassed about the way he looks without, you know, clothes, with just a bathing suit, because he's so skinny and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And we had really, I hate to admit it, had really gone out of line in our relationship by just showing up anyway.
Imposed,
yeah. So George gets dressed and Patty's done with her swimming, and her and my wife start talking about going shopping. They head off, and with the thing that was said to me, that for my rudeness, that I was going to have to pay for it on Rodeo Drive because they were going to go, you know. And so anyway, that just kind of left George and I, and it was lunchtime. And so we went up to the house, and he started making lunch. And we were in this kitchen, and it was kind of like what you call a railroad kitchen. It was kind of long and narrow, so the stove was on one side, you turn around, and there's a sink on the other. They were really close together, but it was a long, narrow kitchen, and there wasn't a lot of natural light from outside. So it was kind of a dim, kind of just a quiet setting. And we're standing there, and he's stirring veggies because he was a vegetarian. He was sautéing a bunch of veggies, and it smelled pretty good. And so he's stirring, and he's talking to me about being a vegetarian. He said that his reasons were clinical reasons or whatever, but besides the health aspects of the food, that he felt that when you eat meat, that when an animal is killed, the animal is aware of him being killed and experiences deep fear, like the moment he hears the gunshot or whatever it is, and the animal dies with fear in his body, and that fear is in his meat.
But the person that ends up eating that
is eating fear.
Oh, you know, never heard that.
So wow. There was other things like that. He just talked about some of his reasons, and it was kind of interesting because he wasn't preaching to me or trying to convert me. It was just something about, maybe the initial question was about having the veggies, and he just kind of, just chatting in the kitchen. We're not doing anything. You know, we're waiting. We're going to have to wait for the girls to come back before we went on to do something else. But that day, he planted seeds in me that I didn't act on for a lot of years, but I became deeply involved in the New Age thing. I came to another time in my life where I was really, really down, really needed something. And the first thing. This is one thing about when you're a Christian, you need to speak to people when you feel there might be something there, because the first people that got in my face were this couple. When I was talking about, hey, I'm troubled about this, they were into the Eastern mysticism. So they said, well, and I was just talking to them, he said, well, look, you know, we have this guru and he's coming into America next week up around Santa Barbara in the mountains, and he's going to do a week of satsangs, which satsang is meetings, teachings, where he teaches. And you just sit around on the ground, and he's under the tree, and he teaches you, you know. I said, well, look, you know, I'm not going to start wearing funny clothes and doing all this chant. You know, I'm not into all that. And I'm not into having a guru. I just, you know, I'm from Idaho, man. I don't do that, you know, type of thing.
Right.
He said, no. He said, all you really do is you learn his teachings and your life becomes better. You don't have to follow him. He's not your guru. But you do listen to his teachings and they're great. So I went. And it was kind of one of the most marvelous days, because here was this beautiful man from India, who lived in Cape Town, South Africa, and he was the founder of a worldwide organization called the IFS, the International Foundation of Spiritual Unfoldment, and he was the man, the guru, over, and there was the society in Denmark and in England and America, and there were different branches. The wisdom was so incredible that day, and the peace and the love. And
it was attractive.
It was attractive, and it was just, and it was what George was talking about, you know. I got deeply involved. I had been raised in the church, like so many of us were and stuff. And all my experiences with Christianity were not that loving and kind. And there was a lot of stuff that made life kind of hard. And, you know, there's an interesting thing about that type of thing is it's easy to be loving and to be forgiving. If somebody is like a druggie and you're kind and you're forgiving him, you let him, but all you're doing is you're just letting each other do what they want to do. You know?
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Having come from that, looking back all these years later,
yeah.
You understand why you were so easily drawn into that?
Yeah. This is something that shouldn't be taken out of my meaning, but it was, these people were acting more like what I thought Christians should act like.
Right.
Than the Christians were, but what I just explained is the reason it's easy to be a New Ager because basically, and this is what I found out, let's say I get into Eastern mysticism, but I want to keep doing drugs. Well, parts of some of the belief systems, that's okay because you do the drugs, you get closer to God and you open up, you know. I don't want to give up sex outside of marriage, but well, you know, God is love. When you're having sex, you're experiencing love. It's a God-type thing. And they've got these—
God created it, so it's an anything-goes kind of a situation.
Yeah, so anything goes. I call it a Chinese menu religion. You know, when you go to a Chinese restaurant—
from column A.
You take one from column A, two from column B, and three from column C.
Wow.
So all of a sudden now, I felt religious. I felt spiritual. I felt a contact with God, and I didn't have to change a thing about myself, and now I was holy, you know?
And the religion that you, quote-unquote, that you had as a child, with the, and we haven't really talked about this in the podcast, but the angry preacher preaching hell, fire and brimstone at you on Sundays and letting you know how real hell was, because you were definitely going there if you went to a movie or whatever that it was happening. This was the opposite. This was... You're going.
Well, you're right, because I grew up, my folks were very religious. When the doors were open, as they say, we were there. I was in the choir. I was in the youth group. I was in vacation Bible school and went to Sunday school and went to the church and the church picnics. And my whole life was the church. Our pastor, all those years, I never saw him smile once. I never saw him or had him say something in his sermons that gave me hope or
encouragement.
Or just something that was attractive. And I'm not talking about adapting your ministry as a pastor to just appeal to people, but there was nothing appealing coming from him. And I swear, as a young kid, every time I left a church Sunday service, I knew I was going to hell before I got home. I just knew it was horrible. But I tell you, I was an obedient child, and this is what I was supposed to, this was supposed to be my life, and I obeyed my parents. But he really messed up one time. And as a kid growing up poor in the country, we lived outside of the small town in what they called the Orchards. Once a week, I got a 50-cent allowance, and on Saturday mornings, they had one of the theaters, they had a thing for the kids. And it was a Western, and it was usually like Roy Rogers or Gene Autry or, you know, one of these people.
Right.
And a cartoon carnival and a cereal. Now, the cereals in those days were the things where the villain, you know, pushes the hero's car over the cliff and you see the car go down. Of course, the hero's dead. Well, next week, he somehow, you know, he's back.
Yeah.
And so I got the 50 cents. The movie was 14 cents, and the bus ride was 10 cents. So that's 24 cents. I always bought a comic every week. That's 34 cents, which left 16 cents. And I, for 15 cents, I could get a hamburger and a Coke.
Wow.
That left a penny.
I didn't know there was going to be a math test.
I didn't mean to put a math. So that left a penny.
Wow.
But that didn't leave money for the bus ride home.
Ah.
So I would choose a lot of times. I wanted the comic book or I wanted the hamburger, and I would walk home.
You walk home, huh?
He, on a Sunday, said that when Jesus came back, because he felt movies were sinful, when Jesus came back, he was going to walk down the main street of Lewis, Idaho, and take everybody to heaven except the people that were in the bars and the movie theaters. And we were the ones that weren't going to get to go to heaven, ever.
Whoa, specifically.
Wow. Now, the next Saturday was the big event. They were having a double cowboy thing. It was going to be Gene Autry and Roy Rogers. It was a cartoon carnival with extra cartoons, and it was going to be the final episode of this serial we have been watching forever.
Oh, boy.
I mean, it was a Saturday that I was looking forward to.
How old are you at this point, Ken?
I'm 11 or something. Right. I don't know, you know, around whatever. And I agonized, and boy, it came Saturday. And I can't go.
You didn't go to the movie?
I didn't go because Jesus was going to come while I was in there.
Yeah.
And I sat at home and Jesus didn't come. And I was so mad at that pastor because I missed that Saturday show. I thought, I'm done. I'm done with this.
That was it.
And that was the seed. I still obeyed. I still went to the church.
I still did everything.
Yeah. But that was the day I wrote this thing off. So it's funny how an incident like that, but now in the New Age thing, now, ironically, after I had pushed religion, I just denied God from then on because the New Age thing didn't pan out either, so.
Well, you just denied the real God.
Yeah,
you,
I denied the real God,
yeah.
That's right. But the New Age thing carried me for 10 years. I mean, I became what the international guru called his favorite chela, and the chela is a student.
A devotee.
A devotee, exactly. And I became his favorite chela, and in the middle of a satsang with maybe a couple hundred people there, he would stop and he would just look at me and say, you inspire me. I mean, the guy had me hooked.
Whoa.
And God, Kenny Rogers had built this brand new, beautiful million-dollar studio in Hollywood. And I got Kenny Rogers to give me free time to bring in the guru. He recorded his messages all day long, which he sent around the world, you know. So, I mean, I was totally, totally in there.
Were you also giving him money?
Well, of course.
Oh, I was going to say.
I mean, oh, gee.
Yeah, well, it's going to, there
but,
you go.
Yeah, well, that was all, you know, well, you know that routine.
Yeah, they're answering some other questions
yeah,
now.
Yeah, but it came to one day to where it wasn't panning out. My life was really awful then. I mean, things had fallen apart so badly for me. And so I called my guru in Cape Town. Now, it's a pretty expensive thing for a guy that's going broke.
Cape Town,
South Africa.
South Africa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because that's where he lived. He was Indian. So I called him and I said, you know, Guru Ji. And when you put G on at the end of guru, it means beloved. So my beloved guru, I'm really going through a lot and I need your advice and I need you to help me through this. And he said, well, Kenji, first, I just want to ask you one question. He said, when you first came to me, you didn't realize that I drew you back from time immortal, back out of the ether. I foreknew you, and I chose to bring you to me. And that's why you had come to me, and that's why you have followed me. Not that he's robbing from other beliefs
right,
at all.
Right.
But, and he said that. So with that being said, how is your life now compared to when you came to me troubled? And I thought, I said, Guruji, my life sucks. Goodbye.
That was it?
That was it. Once again. You know,
he didn't have the answer. He didn't even get what was going on.
He didn't even get a chance.
Yeah.
He asked me the question, and I went, here I've been following him for 10 years, and I'm worse off than I started. And he thought I was going to say, well, yes, I am more blessed now because
yeah.
I've had my guru and stuff like that. The word guru, by the way, as I was taught, gu means darkness, and ru means the light. And a guru takes you from the dark to the light.
Huh.
And so that's probably what he told me, a bunch of other things, you know. So.
Wow.
Anyway. So there I am.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the end of
so
that.
So now you don't, Now you're garrulous.
Yeah, clueless.
Clueless and garrulous, yes.
Yeah.
So you're at a really dark place in your life then.
Yeah.
I mean, literally.
Yeah.
What happens?
God, you
were never out of God's sight, that's for sure.
No,
God knew exactly where you were.
And when I say God had other plans for me, I have no idea. And the thing I want to keep coming back to is God was there all the time. That's pretty obvious. Oh, gee, I'm giving you some great news, you know.
Yeah.
But I can see this immaculate tapestry that was being woven by him all the time, where I was in certain places at certain times. Things could have been 1 second difference and my life would have been different. And I should have been maybe not alive from some of the things I got into. And I could start seeing when I became a Christian that this beautiful tapestry that had been woven, and the guru was a big part of it, because as a New Ager, we had a great discipline. And I got up in the morning and I cleansed my body. I cleansed my mind. I meditated. I chanted. I did candle meditations.
And that was something you were required to do every day, right?
And my day started
with
a discipline, and it was necessary every day. I became a Christian. The next day after I'm a Christian, what do? I've got this discipline in place. I sit down. I open a Bible.
That's what I was going to ask you. When you did become a believer, did the translation, was that an easy thing for you? Because as a believer, that is what we're supposed to do, is meditate on the Word of God and all that kind of stuff. Was that an easy translation for you to? I mean, I'm sure there were some places where you had to make a transition, but you did have the discipline in place of getting up early, and I don't know what the transfer would be of cleansing your body, I mean, in terms of your mind and all those kind of things.
Yes, but preparing yourself for God, to be before God, you know.
Yeah.
And,
the true God.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't the true God then. But
no, I'm saying now you're doing this for the
true God. Like that was so in place. I didn't say, oh, now that I'm a Christian, I got to read the Bible every day. I have to do, oh, gee, I get up in the morning and here's this time space that I've for 10 years. What do I do now? Well, I did what I always did. I was seeking God now.
So meditating wasn't like it was for some of us.
Now there's the problem. Meditation was something where you would go deep into meditation, and as a New Ager or whatever, you were clearing your mind, you know, of other information, so the new information could come in.
Right.
In meditating as a Christian, you are meditating on the Word.
Right.
You're bringing stuff in. You're not cleaning stuff out. You're trying to bring in more of the Word of God. You look at the Bible and you're trying to understand it better, so you're meditating on it. But the thing about sitting down now and closing my eyes and meditating, I couldn't do, because I was too used.
You've been trained.
Accustomed
to
the other one, and my mind would want to clear stuff out. And so I couldn't do it, because if I cleared stuff out, the old stuff, that's where it came in.
Yeah.
And so I just really couldn't do it, even though I know meditation is a different word.
Different discipline. But there was a renewing of your mind that had to take place.
Yeah. But I couldn't do it by sitting down and meditating.
It wasn't automatic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did it with study and as we've been taught, you know, to dig into the Word.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So people would say, well, gee, you wasted 10 years of your life on that. No, there was not 1 second wasted. Because if you and I are sitting here talking right now and you're into that, I understand where you're coming from. Because when I was there, you couldn't have changed my mind. But I've been there, and I know what your thought process is. And if I can't maybe convert you on the spot, but I can at least, I know where you're thinking, I know what to address, and I know what to make you feel foolish about in what you're doing. You know?
Yeah, because you were there. And people like me who have never been near it have no understanding, so wouldn't have the faintest idea how to talk to somebody. Yeah. Who's deep into the Eastern philosophy.
And my years on the road, I would mention something like that. And also in part of my testimonies about when we came together, that she could not be unequally yoked. I mean, that's something she believed Christian. You know,
that's so, another story.
Yeah, it's in the, but as part of this story is here was the guru thing, and this one-liner, I would say, which is part of my conversation. Afterwards, I have people coming to me a lot who were in the metaphysical thing, and I was able to that, but all of a sudden there would be these people coming to Connie that were dealing, Connie's my wife, were dealing with a relationship, and they were a Christian, and the person wasn't, but they thought, so just in that one sentence, she would end up with this little sub-ministry there.
And the sentence being, Jesus is the way.
Yeah.
God was incredibly gracious to you, Ken. And, you know, you didn't waste 10 years. I don't think, but he was certainly gracious in bringing you out of it.
God is the single greatest economist of all time. When you give your life to him, everything that was wasted no longer is wasted. It's something that you can use for his glory.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you not only being a part of this season, but also this tribute to our friend, Ken Mansfield. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Ken's incredible stories.